When we first started to design this computer, we looked at our history, which was from personal computers. And we said, what is a PC architecture? Well, a PC architecture is you go get some memory, and you add to it some video and a CPU, and everything works fine. The problem is that when you decide that you want to go 10 times faster and put 10 times as many dots on the screen, the path to memory burns up and you cannot get the information out fast enough. So PC architecture breaks. And we thought, what should we do? Well, we looked at workstations. And workstations put a cache on the CPU and they put some dual-ported memory on the video and it works. The problem is that's where they stop. Because if you look at a typical workstation, the minute you add a network, it starts to bog down the system enormously. And then you add fast disks. You might add some fast I.O. in terms of a backplane or a bus. You might add something like audio. And for high-quality audio, like you find in a CD player, it demands quite a lot of data. So this can also start to pull your computer down. And you might want to put an attached processor, like a digital signal processor, on your computer, and you've got to get a lot of information to it and back from it. And again, things just don't work. And so what we found was that this didn't work, and we had to invent something new. We asked ourselves, has anyone else done this yet? Maybe we're getting a little lazy as we get older. But rather than reinventing it ourselves, we looked around, and the answer was, of course, yes. Who solved this problem? Mainframes. This is exactly what mainframes have done for the last 25 years. And it may sound funny coming from us, but we decided to copy this architecture. And so what we did was we looked at how mainframes do it. What they do is they have I.O. processors on every single I.O. channel, as they call them. And then they have a very sophisticated memory system which doesn't let the processors into memory until they're ready to get in and very efficiently get out. And what that all adds up to is this. If you look at the overall system throughput of a computer, PCs have about 10 megabytes per second, workstations about 20, and mainframes about 40. And you can see some of the other parameters there. So what we wanted to do was make something like more like a mainframe. But rather than making something like this, which is how the mainframes typically do it, we decided to build a VLSI group, and we put a mainframe architecture on two VLSI chips. It took us 3 years to do this, but the performance is staggering. We are within striking distance of a mainframe. We have one board and about 45 integrated circuits. And this is the board right here. So this is our architecture. We actually use three processors, a Motorola 68030, floating point unit, and a new type of processor to computers, a digital signal processor, and we'll talk a little more about that later. And we have 12 I.O. processors, each with their own direct channel to memory. And you can see what they're for. For the backplane, the serial ports, the printer, the DSP, the audio, the disks, etc. And we can be running all of these at one time and still only be chewing up about a third of the overall system performance. Now, let's take a look at the sound hardware. We wanted to build in sound in this computer. And we thought to ourselves, when you pay thousands of dollars for a computer, why should you get less good sound than you get on a few hundred-dollar compact disc player? And the answer is, of course, you shouldn't. So we built in CD quality sound, built in high-quality digital to analog converters, and we also built in this new thing called a digital signal processor. And a digital signal processor is a processor that's optimized for processing certain types of algorithms about up to 100 times faster than the main CPU. And this is useful for things like sound, music and speech, which we'll hear some of today, faxes, image processing, all sorts of other types of things. And there's one built into every next computer. Now, why did we build it in? Like many things we built into the computer, we discovered in talking with software vendors that if it takes an additional plug-in board that cost a few thousand dollars with a DSP on it, they won't use it in their software because they won't sell very many pieces of their software. They'll only use it pervasively if it's built into every computer. And what they told us is if you want to make a revolution, raise the lowest common denominator and you'll see the revolution happen in the software. And that's what we did. And this is our lowest common denominator. That's the board. These are the two mainframe on a chips here. Processors, custom video, all the networking built in. We'll go through some of this other stuff a little bit later. Okay. Most of you have probably seen pictures of the next computer. I thought I'd run through a few. This is what it looks like. It's in a 1 foot cube. And this is the back of it. We have one board that is the whole computer, as we just saw. We have slots for three additional boards. We have the power supply here that plugs in anywhere in the world. You find the power cord, it works. This is what the inside looks like. Very easy to service. We have room for two full-size 5 1/4 inch Winchester drives inside so that we can put over a gigabyte of storage inside this 1 foot cube. This is what the display looks like. It's on a stand. It tilts very easily. And the back of it, again, has a connector to go to the cube, connector for the keyboard, connector for an external microphone. And it has a speaker built in down below, but it also has a stereo Walkman headphone jack and gold-plated line output jacks to go to your stereo. It connects to the cube. Well, wait till you hear the sound it makes. It connects to the cube with one 3-meter cable here. And that 3-meter cable supplies it video at 100 megahertz. It also supplies it power. So because this works anywhere in the world, this also works anywhere in the world. It supplies it with digital sound, which is converted to analog in the monitor. It takes back the keyboard and mouse data to the cube, and it also takes back the digital microphone data to the cube. So it does its work. And this is our laser printer. It's a very interesting laser printer in that it's a price breakthrough. It also is 400 dots per inch, which is about 75% greater aerial resolution than 300 dots per inch. And it's a full PostScript output. So truly what you see is what you get. Now, let's get to software. We went out and asked software developers, what would be a revolution? We're designing this new computer. What do you want to see? And it was almost unanimous what they wanted. What they told us was, before Macintosh, the world was simple. It had agreed on a user interface of 80 by 24 characters. And when you wrote a program, you wrote the guts, and that was it. But all of a sudden, Macintosh comes along, and Macintosh was a revolution for the end user, but the developer paid the price, unfortunately. And so what used to be 100% of the guts is now only half the code, and they told us that the other half of the code is this user interface gobbledygook. But it's worse, they said. They told us that in many cases the guts is already lying around in C somewhere, that that's not where their time is, that 90% of their time is in the user interface, and that if we wanted to make a revolution to attack that, and we did. What we did was we took that 90% pre-next and we reduced it by almost an order of magnitude by creating something we call an application kit. Full object-oriented programming and a very large body of code that has many objects that every developer will need to build their application, done precisely, done for them. And that got it down to about 10%. But then we went further. We wrote a program that runs on top of the application kit called Interface Builder. Oh, forgot. This is why the application kit works. In a Macintosh, which I love, there are about 400 procedure calls to do the user interface. And if you're an expert over time, you get very good at knowing what they are. We've replaced this. It's actually up to about 25 objects now. That's all you have to know to program this system. And we'll go through a little bit. But we reduced it even further. This program called Interface Builder lets us graphically lay out the user interface and connect things with lines. And we can actually get the time to build a user interface down to close to zero. And we have gotten unanimous feedback from the software developers that this is revolutionary. This is what our software architecture looks like. We use a version of Unix called Mach, which is 100% compatible with BSD Unix. We use PostScript from Adobe. And this is PostScript on the screen as well as the printer. We worked with Adobe to define what's called Display PostScript, which works very, very fast on the screen. As you'll see, everything on our screen is in full PostScript. And then we have these four layers, the Windows Server, the App Kit, Interface Builder, and the Workspace Manager. And together, we call them, these four layers, Next Step. So when you hear that term, that's what it means. And an interesting thing happened. One day, another computer company came and knocked at our door. And they said, we heard you're doing something pretty revolutionary, and we'd like to see it. So we got all of our stuff and we flew back east and showed it to John Akers, because we figured he's not going to run back and program it. And they liked it so much they licensed it from us. And so we actually licensed Next Step to IBM. And what's so interesting about this is that you can develop an application for either platform and nothing underneath the green matters. You can recompile it in a day or two to be running on the other platform with the same user interface, the same training, and the same documentation in a day or two. These are some of the companies developing applications for Next. We'll have about 100 applications out by the end of this year. And what I'd like to do now is take a few minutes and answer a few questions that we get asked all the time that are important questions. There's three of them. The first is, what is the difference between a workstation and a PC? You've just shown us the Next computer. Is it a workstation? Is it a PC? The answer is yes. Let's go through some of the differences. There are some companies that make their living by selling tens of computers a year. And these are the supercomputer companies. Cray comes to mind. There are some companies that make their living by selling hundreds of computers a year, and these are the mini supers. There are some companies that make their living by selling thousands of computers a year, and these are the mini computers. And IBM and DEC come to mind, and also the mainframes. Now, there are some companies that make their living by selling tens of thousands of computers a year, and these are the workstations. And then there are some companies that make their living by selling hundreds of thousands of computers a year, and these are sort of the power PCs, and Compaq comes to mind. And then there's the mainstream PC market, millions per year, and Apple and IBM come to mind. And the whole computer industry is somewhere on this triangle. Now, the reason that I've broken it into two colors is that we'll see some interesting things. Let's examine how these companies sell their computers. How do the companies in blue sell them? Only one way. None of them sell through retail. All of them sell direct with people, right? How do the companies in green sell them? Several tried with their own sales forces, but they all gave up. And 100% of them sell through retail. There's a very clear split. Okay? Let's examine how these companies touch their customers. How does the companies in blue touch their customers? When there's a problem, how do they fix it? There's only one way. They throw people at it. They hire more systems engineers. They hire more technical support people, as an example. But the companies in green learned long ago that they have so many users that they could never hire enough people to touch all of them with people. So there's only one way that they touch their customers, and that is through the product itself. If they can't fix the problem in the product, they're dead. Which means that the focus of these companies is very different. The blue companies are constantly focused on power, however they define it, MIPS, megahertz, number of terminals on a mini computer. But the companies in green, even IBM now, has finally realized that there's a more important focus for the 90s, and that is ease of use. Why? Not because we want to sell computers to morons. That is not why. The reason why is because all of us are spending about as much time as we're ever going to reading computer manuals, learning how to use new programs. We're not going to spend any more time on it than we already are, which means if we want to deliver more sophisticated solutions for the 90s, we have to make the computers easier to use just to stay even. And that is why all the companies in green have decided that ease of use is their number one priority for the 90s. And notice that this thing splits in exactly the same place. Notice also that the workstation companies hired all their people from the mini and mainframe companies, and so they brought their cultural baggage with them. And there is a virtual Grand Canyon between these two perspectives. Now let's examine a few things. This ease of use power trade-off. Power, clearly the workstations have the power. Much more powerful architectures. And they have multitasking, real multitasking, which we need to go into the 90s. Networking, they've got the PCs beat on networking, about, again, an order of magnitude more powerful. Fortunately, they both use PostScript. Ease of use, the workstations are in the dark ages. Very few people in here could take a workstation out of the box, set it up, and be using it the same day. Productivity software, the workstations just don't have it. The PCs do. And then I threw a funny one in here called upgrade model. The workstation companies charge you 1% a month for software maintenance. That's 12% of the purchase price per year for upgrades. The PC companies learned long ago that with all this third-party software out there, they have to have everybody upgrade, so they can't charge much for it. They charge $100 or $200 for upgrades. They give them away, basically. And you can see how this perspective permeates not just the products, but the whole way the companies do business. We need the best of both of these worlds. Let's look and see where people are. Let's go back to this paradigm here, ease of use and power. How many here went to business school? Good. If you did, we'll go back to business school 1A, power versus ease of use. Where would you put IBM computers running MS-DOS on here? Remember who's doing it now. Not so powerful, not so easy to use. I put them there. Now, they're trying to get better. They're trying with Presentation Manager and Windows to move over there, and they're making some distance. They're also trying to put faster processors in the box, but they're running up against a problem. It's not the speed of the processor. It's the software architecture that's giving them their ceiling that they're bumping up against. Faster processors are not enough of the solution. What about the Macintosh? Where would you put the Macintosh? It's about as powerful, but it's easier to use. So let's put it there. And again, they're trying to make it faster with a processor, but they're bumping up against the software ceiling of no multitasking, somewhat anemic networking. Where would you put the workstations? They're much more powerful, but they're even harder to use than the IBM PCs, so we put them there. And they're trying to make them easier to use, but the people that are writing the software that's easy to use are Unix people, and you know what they're used to. So this stuff looks very easy to use to them, but none of us could ever understand it. So where would you put next? Right here. For two reasons. One, we think we're about 3 years ahead of anyone else in understanding some things necessary to do that. And two, it's the only place left. There's very good companies doing the other three. So if we don't survive there, we don't have a reason for being here. We understand that. So this is how we see the market, pretty much, from our simple point of view. Now the last thing I want to do is probably the most important. There have been two revolutions in the desktop computer industry, and there is about to be a third. We think we understand this revolution. I want to tell you about it today, and then I'm just going to walk right over there and show you. What was the first revolution of the industry? Spreadsheet. Spreadsheet circa really happened in 1976. I remember when Dan Feilstra, who started VisiCorp, walked in and pulled this disk out of his pocket about 6 months before it became VisiCalc. Said, I have this visual calculator and I don't know what to do with it. Became the first spreadsheet. That's what fueled the Apple II and then later Lotus on the IBM platform. And that's what really fueled the IBM platform. The spreadsheet was the first revolution. What was the second revolution? Come on. Right. Desktop publishing. Circa 1985, the Macintosh. And that's what fueled the Macintosh. And again, I remember the early days of desktop publishing and how rapidly that started to spread. There is a third revolution starting. We get asked about it a lot. What is the next revolution? We started to understand it about a year ago, and we really understand it pretty well now. Now, let's examine what the nature of that is. We know it has something to do with networking. We've been hearing about networking for years now. Each year is the year of the network, and nothing's different. But we know there's something big coming. We know it has something to do with connectivity. We know it has something to do with email. We know it has something to do with file servers and groupware and getting the paper off our desks. Let me stop for a minute. We started to see this at Next when we put a Next computer on everyone's desk about 18 months ago and connected them together with a very fast high-speed network that's built into the computer and also with our very, very new multimedia mail system. And what we discovered was that within a few months, our meetings were being cut in half in number. But something far more happened. We started to manage the company different, and we finally understood what it was. Business is so competitive now that the business environment is changing constantly. We're having new sales opportunities. We're having new problems. We're having new projects. And we found out that a typical management organization cannot change very fast. You can't have people working for a new boss every week to configure a group together for a changing business environment. It doesn't work. We're also organized geographically. We might have a project in one part of the United States. We can't be moving people around with their families every month. That changes even more slowly than the management organization. So how do we reconfigure the company and change the way people work to meet the constantly changing business opportunities? We do it electronically. And so we have a system now where if we're going to start a project and we want to put 20 people together on that project, we make a mailbox. We put their 20 names on it. And anyone mailing to that mailbox reaches all 20 of them, not with just text, but with full multimedia, as we'll see in a second. And they'll reply to that mail message, and all of their colleagues on that team will get the answers, maybe 30, 40 messages a day. I, as a manager, can put my name on that mailbox because this project is so important and see all of the thoughts, the disagreements, the conclusions fly by my mail system. I can do nothing but watch. I can do some background coaching, or I can get right on there and kibitz. And I have never seen a more powerful tool for changing the way a company works and making it more productive than this. Now, we need a phrase to call this. Sometimes names are very important. And we went back and we looked at desktop publishing. Why didn't we call it word processing? Because all these people using these ridiculous Wang word processors would have thought they had it. And they didn't have it. It wasn't just word processing. It was a whole new capability. So we had to invent a phrase, desktop publishing, to connote it. It was a bucket that you could put these new things into. In the same way, if that. But as we go into the 90s, we're going to hook these things together, and we're going to use them in the same way we revolutionized financial modeling with spreadsheets and publishing with desktop publishing. We're going to revolutionize human-to-human communication and group work. And we're going to call it not personal computing, but interpersonal computing. Is it funny? I think it's profound, actually. And I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about it as the years roll by. And we think that this is going to be the next revolution. And we think we're about 3 years ahead in pioneering this, which is good. And hopefully we can make some contributions here. So with that, I would like to show you what I mean. First thing to notice is the Next computer is fully multitasking. So rather than quitting something, I can hide it. And it will hide it over here behind these icons, in this case, the Next logo. And this is the equivalent of the Finder, and as we move windows around, you can see we move the whole windows and the menus. And if we like a menu, we can tear it off and leave it on the screen. Okay, let's hide this. And let's go look at our mail. We click here, and in a few seconds, we're in our mail. I read my mail approximately 25 times a day. And the reason I do that is because in the middle of working, I can, within 2 seconds, be reading my mail. Here's some mail. Let's take a look. Here's a summary of the messages up here, and I just click on one from James Higa, having to do with housing. And the first thing I note is that our mail doesn't include just normal-looking text. We can have any PostScript text we want in any size or font. And of course, we can scan in pictures and have full pictures. In addition, on the top here, we have a picture of the person that sent it, James Higa. We have the date and the time that it was sent. We can find things. We have all sorts of mailboxes, and if we want to create a mailbox, it's very easy to create a mailbox and file things away. If I want to send this mail to somebody, I just push send and a window pops up here, and I can reply to the sender, or I can forward the mail, in which case the text and the picture gets copied into there, and I can add voice to it, which we'll see in just a second as well. I can delete the message, or I can move between them. Most people never read a manual to use this, and yet it's the most sophisticated mail system that exists. Here's another example of some scanned-in images. We were told that you can go have breakfast at the zoo here. Here's another example of someone sending a scanned image about a recent article about the developments taking place in Singapore and some of the planning that's going on here. So again, we send these images not just around our company, but around the country and around the world through the mail system. Let's move on. This is something that we used when we introduced our product in Tokyo last July with Canon. And this is the voice of Mr. Tanaka, who is the number two person in Canon.
Canon to NEXT の協力関係は日本のコンピューター業界に新
So as you see, the way we got that was that somebody recorded a voice message, very simply, and these lips appeared in the mail message. And I just click on them and I get what's called lip service. And I just push a button that sounds a lot, looks a lot like a simple tape recorder. Here's another one. This is the Canon Company song. Full CD quality sound, sent around the country, sent around the world. Okay. Let me give you another one. And again, you can see how voice is very easy to use and how the recipient just clicks on it to see. Now, voice is interesting and voice annotation, but let's say I write a document in a spreadsheet, in a word processor, or I have a program that I want to send to you. What we do in this mail system is you just drag the icon right in. And here's an icon created with a word processor called Right Now. Somebody wrote a document, they just dragged it in. Here's some quotes from third-party developers about the IBM announcement. They were extremely pleased with the news. I, as the recipient, just click on this thing, and up pops the document in a second here. Should, anyway. There we go. Okay. Here it is. Press release, done in a word processor. And this is an example of inter-application communication, something that the other systems are promising 2 years from now. We've been shipping for a year. Full messaging between applications. Let me show you another example that we'll come back to later. I could pick any word in here. Let's take alliance. And I go over here and I request a definition in Webster's. Remember I told you that we had a full dictionary online? 25 megabytes of data. It got messaged when I made that request. It launched itself. It's looking up the word alliance. And there it is, with the thesaurus as well. So we'll come back to that in a minute. Okay. Here's another one that we're using around Next a lot. This is not a product yet. Everything else you're seeing today is a product. But this is, we decided to automate all of our purchase and check requests. So here's a message. Here's the purchase request I mentioned to you yesterday. If everything's okay, please forward it to purchasing as soon as possible. I just double-click on it. And up comes something that looks a lot like a purchase requisition. I know you probably can't read this out there. I say authenticate it. And I'm asked to type in my name and my password, which is more secure than signing it. And it's a...
Do you really need this?
This is our expense control here.
Well, all right.
So this is how we actually approve things at Next. Okay, let's see here. Again, just to show you the kinds of things we send around, this is an example of a framed document, and we create a lot of our sophisticated publishing in frame. Let's see. And so someone might send this through the mail in terms of a new brochure, in this case, Eddie Lee, who's our chief designer. There we go. And this is actually in the brochure that you got in the packages today. And we not only wrote it, but produced it, got all the approvals, and sent it around for revision, all electronically. Okay. This next one's interesting. Somebody has sent me a Wings spreadsheet. Wings is shipping on our platform. Ashton Tate is announcing an extremely great spreadsheet in June. And Lotus is introducing a revolutionary spreadsheet a little later on this year. But here's a Wings spreadsheet. And I take a look at this. I just double-click on it. And up pops a spreadsheet. No, that's not what I wanted. Huh. Okay. There we go. The Acme Software Business Plan, Revenue versus Expenses. Now, this is interesting, and I can take a look at it, but just a raw spreadsheet with raw data doesn't help me, especially as a manager. So I get on here, and I push audio explanation, and all of a sudden, the spreadsheet comes alive.
Hi, Steve. This is the Acme Software Revenue versus Expense Analysis. If you look at their current business plan, they expect to go profitable around Q3 1991, where those lines cross, and exit Q4 1991 at about $2 million gross revenue run rate. If you take a look at how NextStep can impact that, hit the button that says Show NextStep Impact, you'll see that the number of programmers goes down, development time is shortened, and marketing costs through joint marketing with Next is reduced. That should bring some business in sooner, and bottom line is they'll go profitable by our predictions around Q2 19 is about a year. That's almost a year earlier than they had originally planned. Also exiting Q4 1991, they'll be at about a $5.5 million gross revenue per quarter run rate. That's almost 2x where they were in the original business plan. Secondly, if you hit the IBM Market Impact button, you'll see that the forecast numbers will go up after they port to the IBM platform, allowing their software to reach a greater market. That would leave them Q4 1991 at about a $13 million gross revenue per quarter run rate. Serious impact to their business plan, about 5 to 6 times what they originally thought they could do. Sounds like NextStep is a good fit for them. We'll be working with them to get their project going. Thanks.
Can you do this with your mail system? What do you think of this? To me, it shows why interpersonal computing is going to dwarf the first two revolutions. And the reason is that not only does it revolutionize human-to-human communication, but it includes the first two. I can enclose in it anything I can create with desktop publishing and anything I can create with spreadsheets. And I can add to that voice annotation and some other things along with it, send it off in a package, and reach people instantly. Okay. Let's see. Last thing I wanted to show you was, one of the last things, was here's, this is going to seem a little crude today because we don't yet have full video. But just to give you a feeling for where things are going, imagine if sometime next year you could click on something and get full color video in a window. and we could send this around in a compressed form, fully digitally. This will give you just a feeling for that because it's black and white today and the resolution's not so good.
Well, meanwhile, on this coast, one of Hollywood's oldest talent agencies, the William Morris Agency, and one of Silicon Valley's newest computer companies, Next Computers, announced today the installation of a custom computer system at the agency. It's more than a business story, more than a technology story, because this could affect what you see on the big and small screens. Sherry?
Again, this is food today, but you can imagine where this kind of thing is going. Okay. And the last thing we heard that this was a special week here, so we just digitized some music, sent it through the mail system.
There was a time when people said that Singapore won't make it, but we did.
There was a time when trouble seemed too much for us to take, but we did.
We built a nation strong and free.
So you get the idea of what we can do with this stuff. It's just starting. Okay. Let me show you a few other things that we're doing. We saw briefly the dictionary. Let's go back to it. This is part of what we call a digital library. With so much storage with the optical disc, we got to asking ourselves, well, what can we do with this? Let's write some software that will allow us to find things by free text searching in large databases. So we got a dictionary, which looks very simple, but is actually quite hard. And in Webster's, again, we have the full pictures, as well as the definitions in the thesaurus. And you end up using ought. And you can blast around it very, very fast. As an example, traverse. You can go look up words and you end up using this thing several times a day. So, as you can see, this becomes an extremely powerful tool once it's online, once it's a book that I can turn inside out at my choosing. We also have the generalized digital library online. Now, we include all of the manuals online, but we also put the complete works of William Shakespeare, not so much because everybody needs William Shakespeare, maybe they do, they just don't know it, but so it would inspire people. Let me give you an example. We're going to look through the entire works of William Shakespeare, and one of the ones I like to look up is lawyer. It turns out he referenced lawyers 11 times in his entire works, and we can go look through them, and let's see, where's the one I like? Here we go. In America, you understand, we have too many lawyers. So Shakespeare, anticipating this as he always did, said, the first thing we'll do, let's kill all the lawyers. In Hamlet, we can see him... why might not that be the skull of a lawyer? So, the neatest thing about this, though, is you can put all your own stuff in this. You can take everything you've ever written and drag it into the digital library and find your own works this fast. Contracts, policy manuals, you name it, can be done with this. Okay. And what else can I show you here? Now, one of the real breakthroughs of the system, as we talked about, was the object-oriented programming. Remember the application kit? And remember that program called Interface Builder that I really couldn't make a slide to show you? What I'd like to do now is build an application for you with Interface Builder. And this is what Interface Builder looks like. It has palettes, and I can go over and say, I want to build a new application. And so Interface Builder will give me a menu and a window. I can, of course, get more. Here's my window. And I can change its size here. Now, one of the great things about object-oriented programming is that I can use objects other people create. One of the fastest ways to make something new is to reuse pieces of something that already exists. It also is a very good way to make new things reliable. So this is an object that somebody else did, and it's a graph. It has some graphics with it, so I can show you. Many objects will not have graphics. This happens to be a simulation of a ball inside a chamber, gas molecule inside a chamber. It's PostScript, so I can resize it here. And I know I want to control this with some buttons, so I'll go grab a button from the palette and just drag it and put it where I want. And I want to make it bigger, so I'll make it bigger. And I want more than one of these buttons, so I can just drag out another one or another one or another one. I guess I just want three. And I want to space them apart a little differently, so I'll space them apart maybe this far. And I'll place them right here. Now, so that you can read them, I'll go get my font panel, and I'll make a bigger font for them. I'll ask PostScript to build some new characters. And why don't we just raise the font size to 24 point and set it. There we go. And now what I want to do is I bring out something called my inspector. And this shows me all of the messages that the person that programmed this molecule said it could understand. So when I push this button, I want to send a message to the molecule object, so I just drag a line over there. And this shows me all of the messages the molecule can understand. And I'm going to want this one to be start, so I'll select start here and make the connection. And when I push this one, I'm going to want it to be stop, so I'll drag my line here, and I'll select stop as a message, make the connection. And this one, I'll want to be reset, so I'll select reset and make the connection. And then I'll go back and I'll relabel my buttons. Start, stop, and reset, so I can remember what they do. And now, if I go here and I say test my application, without any compiling whatsoever, we dynamically make all the connections, and here we go, starting, stopping, resetting. Very simple. Okay. Well, now that we've got the urge to do this, let's add some more stuff. Let's grab a slider and drag it over. Make it longer. Of course, I could make a bunch of these if I want, but I just want one. And we'll give it a label here. And let's call it temperature. And let's connect it by, again, just dragging a line over and saying set the temperature. And I can grab a switch over here. And again, let's make it a bigger font. Let's make it, well, let's just say Helvetica. And let's make it, again, 24 point. And let's label this sound. And we can, again, make the connection here and say set the sound. There we go. And I can drag this over, which is another object that somebody else made. They might have not had any idea that these were going to be used together. And I can set a few attributes, which the programmer let me set. Maybe I'll make the background gray and the pen black, so it's easier for you to see. And I'll make a connection here by dragging this over there, and I'll make the connection. And now I should be able to go back here and say test my interface and start it. And we'll see the altitude of the top piston being plotted by the strip chart recorder. I can turn on the sound. I can raise the temperature, which should make the molecule go faster. And I can keep the piston even pegged at the top. I can turn the sound off. And here we are, all in a multitasking operating system. I can go read my mail if I want to. Here. There we go. Now, what's happening is, that this is creating a revolution in the creation of programming. Why? Because programs are now starting to be written backwards, or maybe forwards for the first time. The user interface is being worked on first, and developers are doing a revolutionary new thing. They're getting the users involved. And they're asking the users what they want, and they're iterating on the user interface 10 or 20 times. And only when they get it right do they write the guts. which means the users are being able to specify what they want and get involved in the process far more than ever. And it means that these programs are not only very easy to use, but extremely rapid to develop. Let me give you an example. If after using this program for a while, we decide we need another window, we can just shrink the space here a little bit, add a fourth button, recenter it. Maybe it's an error condition. So we add the word, the title error. We go back over here. We drag out a panel, which we can make any size we want. We'll add a button on the panel. And we'll have this button say, OK. We will raise the size of the font on this button to 36-point Helvetica so we can all read it. And we'll say, when you push this button, send a message to this panel. It says, order yourself to the front. And when you push this button, send a message to the panel. It says, order yourself out. And let's go get some sounds here to make it fun. Let's put a frog on this one here. And let's put a bonk on this one. Okay. Now we go test this again. And after using it for a day or a week or a month, this is how hard it is to add new things to it. You'd want to be a little more creative than this, but you get the idea. So this is what Interface Builder is all about, and I think you'd probably agree that there really hasn't ever been anything like this before. The last thing I want to do today is I want to talk a little bit about music. Now, why music? If we went back 10 years ago and I asked you how many of you want graphics in your computer, most of you would have said, nah, I don't do pie charts. Give me 80 by 24 characters. That's enough for me. And yet, 10 years later, we all want graphics in our computer for a slightly different reason than we ever imagined before, for the user interface, to make them easy to use. And the same, I believe the same thing is going to happen with sound. We are all going to have sound in our computers 5 years from now. For some of the reasons we can anticipate today, voice annotation, etc., but for some reasons we can't. And we do a lot of work with music. We have a little group in the back that even synthesizes music, and I'm going to play you some today. And we can record and play back things to CD quality. So just so you can say you heard it here first, I have no idea what we're going to be doing with this in 5 years, but I wanted to play you some sound. The first thing I want to play you is some synthesized sound, where we actually take scores and by pure mathematics synthesize the sounds to CD quality. What you're about to hear was not ever recorded, but purely synthesized about a tenth of a second before you're going to hear it. Here's an example of a gamelan. Which is an instrument from Indonesia, which many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. Example. We have a lot of electronic musicians at Next, and this is a little strange composition that somebody made. One of the of the other things we can do, of course, is record and play back things to CD quality. We've heard a few of them today. I just wanted to play you a few more. This is a Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello, of course. Okay. Now, we have a real treat today. Rather than just play some recorded sounds, we put together a concert for you today. And we decided that we would have the computer synthesize half of a duet, a Bach concerto in A minor. And to play the other half of the duet, we asked Miss Lynette Cie, who is the deputy leader of the Singapore Symphony Orchestra and has played with leading orchestras around the world, to accompany the computer and to play a duet. Miss Lynette Cie. Thank you.